Let me just sort through my documents here, make sure I'm on point. So my grandfather, Lloyd Pound, is really the reason why we have what we have. We owe a lot to him. When he came back from the war, he ran a little fishing hut and charter off of Cameron Lake, a little gas station, and then he created a couple little cottages on there to house the people who are chartering. That was his first venture. But then he had a crazy idea that he saw classifieds in the paper of houses for sale, and there was no local real estate brokerage around here. And that was a new concept at the time, because Lindsay, during this time, pre-1950s, if you didn't make things with your hands, something tangible you could give and sell, and you kind of just made money off of the backs of other people that made things, you were kind of looked at as a rent seeker. You were just taking from other people's creations. That value-add concept and streamlining things wasn't really a concept in Lindsay at the time. So he created the first brokerage in Victoria County in 1956. And from there, he branched out to appraisal. At the time, there was no Appraisal Institute of Canada. He had applied for a license out of California or Florida, I believe. I forget which one. And he just sent in a letter, paid the dues, and he got a receipt saying he was an appraiser. But he was one of the few appraisers in Ontario at the time because of it. And so he started growing his real estate portfolio. And the reality was, is he was a land baron, really, is he speculated on land. He kind of had this intuition of knowing which lands were going to become more valuable. And back in those times, you didn't go to banks, get loans, had a whole bunch of cash flow. Really all what it was is, do you know who owned that piece of land? You had some other land that might have want. Half the time you're just trading deeds, just, and a little bit of cash or whatever it was. And over time, he accumulated a good amount of land. The problem is land doesn't generate any revenue. And it works well because he had a real estate company that he was selling, real estate and getting commissions. And he was, because he was one of the few appraisers, he was an expert witness in a lot of court cases. So he was on for that. And through all of it, he always had the lens, because he came up, he was the youngest out of 12 on a farm, just south of Little Breton. And so when he came out, it was kind of a rags to riches type of thing. He didn't have anything going for him. But he always knew about the tenacity of farming, is that you feed the soil and the crops will come. And so in his view, community was the soil. He understood that implicitly. Because of that, it was always ingrained into him and ingrained in my father and in turn ingrained into me and all my siblings, is that when you do well in a business, it is because the community supports you. It is a community-based thing. And so you always have to make sure that you give back to the community that gives you your opportunity. And because of that, my grandfather, he was a deputy reeve of Lindsay, and he was the town councillor for many years. He helped start the Lindsay Chamber of Commerce and was his first president. And he sat on a lot of boards that I can't even remember now as well. There's an interesting story. He was always kind of a charismatic man, if anybody knew him. I personally didn't know him. Unfortunately, he passed before I was born. But, stories passed down. And I got some local newspaper clippings to prove some of these in my office. But there is one of them where, if anybody remembers when the lagoon for the wastewater was first built in Lindsay, there was a big uproar because they were worried that it wasn't drinkable and it was going back right into our local water supply. And so my grandfather, when he was the deputy reeve, he went to the lagoon and he said that he's going to drink from a cup direct from the lagoon just to showcase it. And so sure enough, the paper was there. I think it was the Lindsay Post. And he drank from the cup of water, and everyone was just waiting on speed dial, wondering whether he was going to get sick or not. But sure enough, he didn't, and then the lagoon story went away. So that was one of them. There's lots of anecdotes I could do about it. But the seed that was planted was that, community. And so my father, in his turn, he came back when he lived in Montreal. He worked for a big company called Trisec that was in commercial real estate. They were responsible for a lot of the big malls of the day when malls started coming out. And he traveled all over Canada and around the world you know, helping build these malls and get them leased up and everything else. So he was part of kind of the same business. And then my grandfather ended up getting sick with ALS, a specific type of ALS. And so my father came back to save a business that during the time, rich in land holdings, low in cash flow. And so we had to sell a large portion of our lands in order to keep on funding it. And so my father, really, his first 6 years in the business really set his tone for the rest of the business because it was the hardest he's ever had to do. He never took a salary. He built Kent Place with my grandfather at the time. And my grandfather said it was too big for Lindsay. It's not going to do well. And he was right, largely. You know, the whole second floor was basically empty. You could sit on one side and see the windows on the other side of the building. And it stayed like that for years. And to compound high interest rates, lower property values, everything else, my dad had a fire sale, what was a vast set of land holdings, in order just to survive. And at the end, the only thing he held was Kent Place. If we were able to even keep a fraction of this, I would be a wealthy trust fund kid. But he wasn't able to. Some of the lands were where the Canadian Tire is, Lindsay Square Mall, some properties in around Little Lake and Peterborough, you know, lots of different land holdings. And so, but he never lost sight of the community aspect. So my father kind of stepped in his footsteps. He was the counselor for Ops Township right before amalgamation. He sat on lots of local boards. He championed a lot of local events. One of the ones that he held dear was local arts and the art gallery, which is the reason for the Quartz Found Art Fund and the reason why I'll get into it, why we're partnering with the art gallery. So between real estate on the side and family farming on the other, land stewardship was the water I grew up in. I just did not have a name for it until I took over the family business. So the point of the family story is not the family, it's a way of thinking that was a product of being a part of the family. And so drive across this municipality and you'll pass through other people's foresight. Fields somebody cleared, Main Street somebody built, shade somebody planted for a view they would never see. In a farm community, you learn to plant for shade that you may never sit under. When a family keeps showing up on the same Main Street for four generations, service turns into stewardship, just like a farmer. The town knows the family, and the family plans in decades, not financial quarters. And that is the premise and really the whole arc of the business I manage today. So that way of seeing a town did not come from a book. It came from a set of tools I picked up along the way. So my set of tools. I grew up in a family business. I also grew up helping on the farm all the time. And so I was kind of a juxtaposition because I was good at working with my hands, but I also was pressed to go to university. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I maxed out my first year credits, taking all types of courses all under the sun just because I didn't know. But then I stumbled on an economics course, and I stumbled on human geography. And a lot of people think economics is about numbers, and it is. And to be fair, I actually really sucked at numbers when I first started out. I was very behind the times, and I questioned whether I was even going to graduate because I wasn't that great at numbers to start. But the reason why I was successful, what a lot of people don't realize, is economics isn't more about the numbers. The numbers backs up a philosophy, a way of thought. It's really what it is. Everything has trade-offs. Everyone is incentivized to do something on a daily, on a monthly, on a yearly, in anything that they do. And everything they're incentivized has a trade-off. If I open one door, the other door closes. And a lot of things in business is the same. You can't test alternatives. It isn't like a scientific method where you have a control group and a non-control group. It isn't like I give one province free healthcare and another province not. You're dealing with human beings and human systems. In that regard, an economy is like an ecosystem. That's all what it is. It's an ecosystem where all of us trade services amongst one another, trying to fulfill each other's needs. The money is just the medium of which that makes it possible. Makes it easy, makes it expedient. That's all. And so, really, when you think about it, you know, the way I applied this is I practiced as the economist when I first got out of school. I absolutely hated it. You know, I worked for government, you know, I worked for a private consulting company, and then I worked for government, and each case was the same. I produced these fancy reports that justify what is already of an opinion that they want justified for a large portion. Or I produce a report that is kind of groundbreaking, saving a lot of money, produced a lot of things, but it sat on a shelf just to say that they looked into it, to assure anyone that it's there. Now, I'm not saying that it's not the whole field is disparaging. That's what I experienced, and being brought up, being able to work with my hands and be able to see the fruits of my labor and seeing how things work, I was just naturally meant to be an entrepreneur. That's just the reality of it. And so I came back. I worked. I came back, and I was applying for jobs, licked my wounds because I didn't like what I did. I thought I was just going to stay here until I found a job, went to it. But within a few weeks, I told myself, I don't care if I have to open up a hot dog stand, I'm staying here. And out came, you know, perseverance of I need to find something to do and get paid doing it. So I created a consulting company called Found Analytics, which was about bringing analytics to small businesses that otherwise might not have it. And a lot of these businesses are struggling and don't realize they knew, didn't know what they need. So it was partly education component. It was partly that I was helping out struggling businesses that didn't have the money to pay me. And once they had money, they had bills they wanted to pay first before me. And so it was difficult to chase that around, and once I started having a family, that's when I started working for the family business. But all those tools led to the same outcome, which is that, you know, when you watch things close up, you see how people really choose things. And that's really the basis of any business, is how do you service the customer? How do they make choices? What services do they really need? And how do you fulfill those services in the most streamlined way? And so, really, across businesses, there's a first principles transfer. And you strip any business down to its foundation, and the same tools run all of them. For a commercial portfolio like ours, really when you think about it, is that you have tenants, pay your rent. But really what we're doing is we're administering costs to those tenants. You know, what's the operating cost of the building? What's the capital upkeep? What's the marketing cost? And how do you funnel those to ensure that they're optimized in a way that match what the tenants need to make it seamless? But that's the same as running a BIA. So I'm the chair of the Lindsay Downtown BIA, and I've done a lot of unique things that I won't get into here that was recognized at the Ontario BIA level, because no one's really had a property owner and an economist sit on the local board, let alone have those insights transferable across other BIAs, because they are. And so BIAs is actually an Ontario-born invention. It was born in downtown Dundas because of the big bad mall started coming in and stealing a lot of their tenants and a lot of their clients. And so you had a whole bunch of downtown merchants that just kind of banded together, and they had this audacious idea to go to the Toronto Council and tell them that for this specific boundary, I want you to tax us more on our property taxes so we could pool that money together to promote and beautify this area to try to bring more people downtown. And what they didn't realize what they were doing is they were actually just piggybacking on the same model that the malls were doing. So a mall, you know, usually has leases, and they're called net leases. And one of those specific charges on the net lease is a common area marketing charge, so the mall can advertise itself. So, you know, we're going to charge you, you know, $4 per square foot, so we could put in this pool of marketing. So, you know, we could do Christmas events. We could bring the Santa. We could advertise in the local newspaper saying, come to our mall. And then they beautify it. They put plants in. You know, all these type of things get charged back to tenants. And really what they're doing is the mall corridors were their streets. That's where people walked around on. That's where everything is. Now, what a BI did the same for property owners. It's like, let's tax the property owners. Let's pool that levy so we can put flowers downtown. We can make the streets nice. We can promote the downtown. And we can make sure that our destination is a destination that's promoted collectively as a place to come, as an individual shops. So they just stole the mall model that started making them die and just put it towards the BIA. But managing those tools is the exact same way as I administer our operating costs of our building and charge it back to tenants. No BIA ever did this in a meaningful way and actually quantified it, because really what happened in BIAs is they're like, a property owner come and be like, I don't know why I'm paying these thousands of dollars in the levy. What do I get for it? A BIA usually is like, I don't know. You get stuff, but I can't quantify it. But it's easily quantifiable because it's the same model, same principle. And so once you look everywhere, it's the same structures. You know, how you run commercial products, the same as how you run a BIA. How you optimize a menu for a restaurant is the same way that you optimize a product mix for any retail shop. It's all the same tools once you boil it down to first principles. So where am I going with this? I want to relate this back to community, downtowns, hub places. What's first principles? What's the first relationship that governs everything else? So my theory. Community here started with land in Lindsay, like any place. And just like any point in time. Roman Empire, it was bathhouses. You know, you need a place to commune. And implicitly that involves land. And where people commune, they tend to connect business, whether it's personally, professionally, whatever it is. But the first principle is land. And so that land drew people together. You know, market day, the fall fair. That gathering became our culture. And trade grew out of that culture. And that trade is called commerce. And so when you talk about the order of operations, it is culture that comes first. It's a reason to gather. It's a reason to exchange ideas, things, goods. And that becomes commerce. Without that place in that culture, it's not commerce, it's transactions. And that's the fundamental of it. So a place that produces nothing can still have stores. Goods can arrive by truck. But everything real here grew from the ground up. Culture is upstream of commerce. You cannot manufacture it. A mall and a chain are manufactured culture and community rather than from the grassroots. They produce transactions, not commerce, like a downtown would, like a common place to gather, like a church, like anything. So a transaction is passive. You trade money for a thing and you leave. It produces a receipt. Community is active. Human way, people preserve, people serve one another. That's the ultimate. So why do I come back to this? It's because, you know, as a farmer, you're a steward. As a landowner, you're still a steward, but you're a steward in a different way. You're a steward to providing the highest and best use of that land to service the community's needs. So working the land was never one person's job. A landowner works his ground for a while. Then the deed changes hands. The municipality is the one farmer that never leases. It holds the ground rules for every acre and every village and township across the generations. So, in my view, that is the oldest job in local government. And every farmer knows the rule that governs a source. Feed the soil, not the crop. So the question that decides everything is simple. Is the relationship between the landowner and the municipality still feeding the soil? So this is where I delve into the little bit of the political angle of it. And I'm not going to deny that I don't have a vested interest in these type of things. But my goal is pointing to the source of the truth. What are the fundamentals? What are the first principles? Just like the same tools that govern commercial real estate governs a BIA, or governs how profitable a restaurant is how profitable any retail establishment is when you put it to bare bones. But when you look across municipalities and you look at some that seem to do things better than others, if you break it down to first principles, it comes down to relationships, comes down to the land, comes down to the essence and the spirit of how people get together to assess the highest and best outcomes for that land. Because when you start, how do we help this ground produce? That is the spirit of the relationship. And it doesn't produce right away. I benefit from forefathers' actions on the land to make it productive. The downtown was there before I was born. The people who produce from it, from the job numbers, the vacancy rates, the amount of people that generate income there, to the amount of money that's spent, those are all what I call lagging indicators of what the forefathers stewarded the land, how they stewarded the land. And so when I look at all of that, break it down to the first principles. What are leading indicators for what, how we're feeding the soil and what the crop that we're going to produce for next year, for our next generation, for my kids? And too often, I think it has quietly become, is this file complete? Instead of, is this the highest and best use of the land to allow people to commune and have commerce and have culture? That is measuring the crop, in my view, and ignoring the soil. Now, I'll end up being fairness here. This isn't me just ragging on the municipality. Because every municipality is different. Every municipality has their inherent limitations, history of where they come from. And largely the people at the desk aren't the people who have the decision of managing how they approach files. They just are the executors. They're part of the system. And all of them are good actors and meanwhile and want to do good things. Same with the municipality. And every rule is written for a good reason. And the people at the counter did not build the pile. They work inside it. I just think that nobody has stepped back in quite some time to ask what the pile does to the soil underneath. And really that is no one's fault. It's what economists call the tragedy of the commons. A guardrail that becomes a destination stops being protection and turns into friction. And the friction is not the only thing keeping up these projects. There's other economic factors. There's construction costs, financing. The pull of the city all play their part. Friction does not drive the car. It takes a break off. But it is the part that we actively control. And so I'm living this right now. And, you know, our part is only a little part of it, and I'll get into the proof of it. But in general, Lindsay in the city of Cold Lake, it's not in trouble. The buildings are here. The owners are here. The demand is definitely here, as we've been seeing the last few years. The question is never survival. It is about direction. And small changes in direction compound to a strategically different end outcome over time just by small changes. And so, the proof. So, on one end, you know, we have a downtown. And if you look at the streetlights here, at nighttime, do you see many lights on? You don't, right? Anybody walking downtown at night knows that, you know, it's a place to do things during the day. The downtown services the greater community, but it doesn't have a community in its own right. And, you know, those are structural issues. And so I'll give you one or two characteristic examples that is on our plate is Limborough. So a little bit of background in Limborough in its current state. We have one building in Peterborough on Lansdowne Street, but the majority of our holdings are downtown Lindsay. We have Kent Place Mall. We have the Scotiabank building. And then as many of you know that you probably want to hear about is we have 19 Cambridge that's going to become the future art gallery. And then we just bought the building about a year ago beside the art gallery, which is 23 Cambridge. And so I'm going to use 19 Cambridge and 23 Cambridge as some examples. So a little bit of history of 19 Cambridge. As many of you may know, it was one of the old livery stables of the downtown. You know, before there was cars or anything else, you needed a place to either store your horse or you need a taxi service that involved horses, either to deliver goods or ship people around. So that was one of them. That was its original thing. And then it cycle through a few different things over the years, and then one of the things that some people might remember here is that it was the bus terminal. So if you want a litmus test of legislative inflation, is that during its heyday as a bus terminal, there was approximately about 74 buses that came through there a day that went all across southern Ontario and greater. And it did it seamlessly. And it did it in a way that was community. It's kind of a community hub. There's a sandwich shop. There was a whole bunch of different things there. And it was even how kids got to and from school sometimes, too. And there was no bus connections to the school that they wanted to go to. And the issue being there is that imagine during the heyday you could fit 74 buses that go hundreds of kilometers any which way all around connecting Lindsay to the greater community. And now we can't find a place for GO Transit to go just for interregional transit, either to Peterborough or Oshawa or anywhere else. And the issue isn't necessarily some of its demand, but some of it's finding the right location that size right, fit right, based on current legislative characteristics. So if you want a litmus test of legislative inflation since the 1960s, 70s, you know, that's one good litmus test. I'll go into the mechanics of 19 Cambridge. So there's been some issues. Some of it's our fault beforehand, but once we actually started communicating with the municipality properly, there was a contractor in between that we had to let go, and then we commenced the file directly. But once we start communicating with the municipality, we submit the permit on September 12th. And then for anybody with assembled occupancy, it's a 20-business-day turnaround for the building department to render judgment on your permit and provide feedback. And so the clock started at September 18th once they said that the file was complete and it was submitted. 20-business-day window for the city to reply. It took until February 13th to hold that permit in our hands. 5 months. Inside those 5 months, 4 full rounds of back and forth. Every time the city came back with another small request. And so it was ironic because the 20-day turnaround for the first one, it was pre-scheduled, I believe, because it came the last business day they were allowed to hold it at 4:56 p.m. So it's as if they scheduled the send to be end of day. And there may be about 6 kind of fluffy questions on there. And this is kind of known in the community of being like, we didn't have time to fully assess your file, so I'm going to cherry pick a few things that allows me to start the time over again. And so when they made those requests, the 20-day clock reset to 0. Now, if you look at the schedule, after the file was initiated, they did their first request. They didn't actually take the full 20 days each cycle. They responded, you know, what I think is reasonable. But each request, when they piecemealed out, because of assembled occupancy, you needed every single engineer no demand. You had a structural engineer. You had an architectural engineer, HVAC engineer, electrical engineer, all in the file. So each request, we had to figure out what they're asking us, and then we had to relay it to the engineering firm. And then they took a few weeks to get back to us because, you know, we aren't, you know, a little 6,000-square-foot building, we aren't their top file. Just not what it is. And so by the time, you know, the request came back to resubmission, you're talking about a 2-week question became a 6-week round trip to submit back to the municipality. So you can imagine this happening over 4 submissions led to February 13th. To permit issued. And so really the way I see that it could have been, and this happened in the old day, Lindsay, you went to the permit office. You had a human discussion. You went to the actual site. You talked to the people. And they were more like, how can we make this work? And in my view, a lot of the permits, a lot of the stuff that they had issues with, they're legitimate issues. Yeah, we overlooked that. Yeah, you're right. That specification needs to be correct. But they were way down the pipeline of the actual build. Like, pretty much 90% of their questions were probably, you know, 4 month in concern, construction. They could give us a preliminary permit, provided that all this stuff will come due. And other municipalities do that, too. So the requests are largely corrections to things any builders know by trade. And so that would be a part of the reason, you know, give us a conditional thing, knowing that, you know, you're going to come and inspect these things and you aren't going to let us progress unless these things are solved and ratified. So, the building 2, 23 Cambridge. Same block, turn of century building. But the governing bylaw is a circa 2000 Town of Lindsay commercial zoning bylaw. Now, the municipality knows that these bylaws need to be updated. They start with a rural zoning bylaw. That's completed. There's the commercial one, yes. And so the municipality wants to take all these ground floor premises. It's a fourplex at 23 Cambridge. And so when we bought it, it was operating as a duplex, completely residential. We had a vision to turn it into a fourplex and make the ground floor commercial. This is the municipality's desire. They actually have it in their zoning bylaws that it must be commercial. Now, the way that current building owners get away with it is that they secretly renovate it as residential and then they get a residential lease signed to it and therefore it abides by the Ontario legislative acts, which trumps any local acts, so the municipality can't do anything once it's tenanted by a residential tenant. But we're trying to do the right thing. We want to make it commercial because we want to see downtown grow. We want to be a steward to the downtown. We want there to be more commercial agency. And so we want to make the ground floor commercial. But all of a sudden, there's a change of use clause. And when it's a change of use, you aren't grandfathered into any of the zoning, which means that you have to abide by the Lindsay zoning bylaw pre-city of amalgamation that never contemplated wanting permits to be done for these buildings that were built before the zoning bylaw that can't in any way stretch or form conform to that zoning bylaw. There's no provisions in there for carve-outs for buildings like that. And so we had to go for a rezoning. Sorry, not a rezoning, a minor variance request. And so the minor variance request is dealt with by the Land Planning Committee within the municipality. And these are the ones that do zoning requests, you know, minor variance requests, things of that nature. Anything from huge subdivisions to a minor 6,000-square-foot building like this. That committee only meets once a month. And you can imagine the volume of growth that's happening in Lindsay, that the amount of files that need to cross their path is quite large. But in order for us to make application, we need a site plan, we need an engineering report, we need to pay close to $1,000 to be a part of that, we need to fill out this complex form. And for someone who does this as their trade, it was difficult to navigate. Imagine trying to do it once, right? And it's a fixed cost. This is a little 6,000-square-foot building. If I had a 100,000-square-foot building, it would be still the same hoops. So why do you think many people aren't touching these downtown buildings? It's a lot. And so when we submitted the request, the nice person at the front desk, you know, managing the paperwork, is just like, you know, by the volume of work, you're likely going to have to wait 3 or 4 months until it becomes a part of their agenda. And in my view is that this, all the stuff we requested, the planner who was there, won't mention the planner, but he basically was sympathetic to us. He's like, look, this is the only mechanism of which that allows you to get your permit to do this. But unfortunately, there's no mechanism that doesn't allow you to have to go through a minor variance. And so this is the only avenue you have to go for, but physically your building is limited and there's no physical way you could do this without getting the minor variance. And so there should have been another avenue where we didn't have to go through that whole process. But it is like trying to put in a screw with a hammer. There needs to be more tools. And all these are within the control. And then, all of a sudden, we submit that. 6 months later, no, not 6 months. Close to 5 months later, we finally got the minor variance approved. And in lockstep, we're trying to put a new deck in. And it's about 1.5 meter elevation. And then the building department, within their own building code, has a provision that it is average established lot line to zero variance, which is a fancy way of saying that if the established line on that side of the street in all the buildings is that the average lot line is X, that means that it trumps you needing to go onto city property or whatever it is, like the minimum setback requirements. It's all technical, so I'm trying to dull it down a little bit. But even though that's within their own zoning bylaws, and the department is actually only about a 30-second walk away, I had to go show them the picture of that, point to the exact clause in their zoning bylaw stating why we don't actually need to go for another separate minor variance for that specific thing. And all this isn't set to the individual. Each individual agent within the municipality means well, wants to do well, lives in Lindsay, you want Lindsay to do well, or within the city of Corthlake. It's no individual agent problem. I have no doubt everyone wants the best. And so the question went in a circle. So even though it was in the building department, they requested that I get the planner's opinion that that is indeed the case. When the planner said that this isn't even in their purview, so I got circled around between the building department and the planning department, and still am with this. That part's not resolved yet. Just for a deck. And I need to put the deck in before we do anything else because we have other tenants going in. So I've owned this property for about a year now. Probably about 8 months out of that year is just trying to navigate the municipal process. So how now these two files that I show you, but here's the part that matters most. It's the part that you can never see. If you broaden this, not just in our example, and I'm a seasoned person that understands these processes better than the average. Imagine if, you know, you are a single entity. You want to put a garage on. You want to convert your barn. You want to put a shop in. You want to do all these type of things. But here's the hidden part. You cannot count the barn that was never converted, the shop that never opened, the addition a family talked themselves out of. And no town is ever told when a manufacturer quietly crosses them off the short list. The losses that count us, that cost us the most, leave no file behind. That is why the problem survives. We keep asking for proof of losses that, by their nature, leave no proof. Here's what we can see. Walk any block downtown and look up. On the conservative figures, sorry, I forgot to go through the slides. So this is 19 Cambridge when we bought it for the art gallery. And I'll show you where it came, but I'll diverge a little bit. My dad, when he was sick, he asked very little of me. He had all surety that I'll do all the right things. But the one thing he asked about me is not lose sight of the art gallery, because he was a lifetime supporter of him. If anybody was in Kent Place before the renovations on the second floor, you would have seen there's beautiful artwork all along there. That was all purchased over many decades from the art gallery. And when I was doing renovations, it was going to fit into the overall theme. So I'm just like, the one thing he asked of me, I'm going to get rid of all these paintings, and then there's going to be no cause to deal with the art gallery anymore. So I donated all the artwork back to the art gallery, and they sold it. And it's just like, well, that was good, but now there's no relationship going forward. And then I created the Kent Found Art Fund. It's a legacy project. But while I was working with the art gallery to create this fund, I kept on going up to their not-so-great location. Well, it's nice, but it's just out of the way, in the library on the second floor. And then that's when we had this building, and I was considering tenants. I'm like, what better way than giving them a new lease on life on a ground floor premises that they get to control and use? So I talked to them about it, and they really loved the idea and everything else, but they went back and looked at the finances, and the exec director, Susan Taylor, came back to me and said, it's a lovely offer, but we can't find a path to really afford to do it. And then I looked at her, and I'm like, you know, you have to first judge things by good ideas. And if this is a good idea, don't let a small thing like money get in the way. Because remember, money's just a transaction for a community and culture and everything else and how to serve one another. I'm like, I'm going to take no for an answer. I'm not going to take no for an answer. I'm like, figure out another way. And that's when she went to the city and went to council and gave a good proposal of third places and culture in the community and getting library to have more space because they need to expand. So let's help our cultural community and our nonprofits make a considerable investment, because that's what it is. And so the municipality entered into an MOU with the art gallery to help them realize moving into here. So you can imagine the palatable irony. On one hand, they gave them the ability to realize this move, but in a separate department's hand, they delayed it by a huge margin. And so I find that an irony thing that if the municipality looked at serving one another and looking at the stewards of the land, both of them, the municipality and the landowners, as someone that needs to be in business together instead of someone who's in opposition or as someone where the inherent policy is limited. So step back a little bit here. When you walk any downtown block and look up, this is something the BIA did. On the conservative figures, 30% of the second floor space and 60% of the third floor spaces sit vacant. My own read to the advocate was higher, 40 to 50%. Even on the low figures, the empty space in this one town of 20,000 people is equivalent of, or a little over 20,000 now, of 200 and 10 studio apartments, or 126 one-bedrooms, or 84 two-bedrooms, already built, already standing. It's just dark. And here's who I'm asking to bring them back. Nearly 6 in 10 businesses in this country have 4 employees or fewer. More than 3 in 4 have fewer than 10. These are owner-operators who have no planner on staff. No ability, even though that they own these buildings, to figure out, even to start, how to converting these beautiful spaces and converting the downtown to not just to serve the greater community, but have a community own right, to even figure out how this is even possible. Because it's a small business. It's the lifeblood of our whole country. And the fire escape and pad alone can run $20,000. A single second floor unit, $100,000 or more. And the cost is the same whether the building is 6,000 square feet or 100,000. So a smaller owner does the math and leaves the lights off. I've had the pleasure of viewing some of these empty spaces, and they're big, bright, and beautiful with great potential. This is above what was Appleseed Quilt Works. They're one of the ones I renovated. Look how beautiful that is. That could be all downtown. So the ground is willing. The only question left is whether the one farmer who never leaves will tend it, which is the municipality. They have incentives in place. They have a CIP program, a community improvement plan, that has a lot of these incentives already in there. They're just toggled off. It just takes a vote of council to vote it back on. So the stakes and the oldest job. When the ground stops producing, the place becomes more about transactions than community. This doesn't have to be the case. And we see it slowly, year after year, is that the town is growing, but it feels like it's becoming quieter at the same time. Almost like a bedroom municipality. The people who love it sleep here and live somewhere else. Downtown stays the heart, but almost nobody lives inside of it. And that's the sad truth about all of it, is that you can experience growth economically or size or whatever else, but you can experience a decline in culture and the community at the same time. But if you honor that oldest job between the steward of the land that is the landowner and the municipality, and view it from those first principles, I don't think it needs to be that case. So it's not a story about a bad municipality. It's that a municipality sees all these problems happen out, and they see that they have solutions. And they do drive solutions. You know, a case in point is the MOU they entered in with the art gallery. It was great. It was worthwhile. It was forward-looking. And there's countless examples of the municipality doing those exact things. But I think sometimes is that with growth, you lose sight of the first principles of why the municipality exists in the first place, and that's to tend the soil, to manage the permit office, to manage buildings, to manage that the land that you're having is the highest and best use, and you're working diligently so that people can serve each other on it using that highest and best use. And so the province has already handed council most of these permissiveness we still think is missing. There's up to 3 units on a service lot as a right. Parking barrier stripped by regulation. Council is being handed freedom and has not really operationalized yet. The only real provincial gap left is the building code's change of use triggers. Be loud about fixing that, we should be. And quick to use what we have already been given. If you want one number to watch, it is this. How long from a complete application to a decision by permit type published every quarter from the permit office? If you want a leading indicator about what a good crop's going to be for tomorrow, it would be that. And it could be published tomorrow. They collect all that. And so, momentum is guaranteed. Direction is chosen. What we tend grows a little every year. What we neglect fades the same quiet way. We know where the fading ends, and it's a choice. It's not a fate. The gallery is the whole argument in one building. One arm of the city fed the soil. The other spent 5 months weighing the crop. The instinct was right. Carry it all away to the counter. And this town changes. We were handed grounds that others fed for generations. We shouldn't take that lightly. Planting shade for views they would never see. We feed the soil. We turn lights back on above the shops. And we hand the next generation a Main Street this community does not just visit, but actually lives on. That's my argument. And this is actually a paper that a white paper that was commissioned by OBIA, the Ontario IBIA organization, of which that I was cited in quite a bit because I was one of the ones pushing for this to be represented a little bit more, because our problem downtown Lindsay is endemic across a lot of historical downtowns across Ontario. So it's a good one to read. But that's the end. Thanks.